Light is one of those words that can mean a lot of things. It's the electromagnetic energy that lets us see. It's also a metaphor for truth, enlightenment. And it turns out that those two kinds of light, literal and symbolic, came together in the 18th century. Historian Darren McMahon has been thinking about this a lot, and he told Steve Paulson that it began, for him, with one of those light bulb moments.
It occurred to me at one point that, gosh, you know, the 18th century is not only the age of enlightenment in an intellectual or spiritual sense, but it's also the age of public illumination. And surprisingly, there's very little work done on this. And so as I started poking, I was able to satisfy my interest in 18th century culture and history and learn about light in the process.
Now, those would seem like two very different things. I mean, enlightenment, I mean, the age of enlightenment was sort of this dawn of rationality, science, kind of a rejection of religion, and then lighting. I mean, you're talking about public lighting, right? Cities becoming lit up at night.
Absolutely, right. Well, the 18th century, as you say, is a kind of new departure. And I think historians now would be a little bit cautious about talking about a rejection of religion, but certainly a critique of religion and an appropriation, if you will, of what has been the dominant Christian narrative that God is light, right? And the darkness is evil, Satan. And Enlightenment thinkers take that metaphor, that Christian metaphor, and they make it their own. Light and enlightenment stand for, as you say, rationality and progress and clarity and health. But at the same time, they're lighting cities publicly, as you say. The very first city in Europe that's lit publicly is Paris, City of Light, and it earns that nickname in the 18th century.
So there was actually public lighting starting in the 1600s in Paris.
Exactly. 1667, Louis XIV issues an edict, and Paris is the first city in Europe, followed very closely by Amsterdam, some cities in northern Europe, and then by the middle of the 18th century, really every sizable city in Europe has public lighting. So this is a new phenomena, and it has really profound effects on the way human beings live, and it's happening in the same period of the Enlightenment.
So why did Louis XIV and these other rulers, these other governments, why did they care about lighting cities?
The most important reason, the most pressing reason, was security. The night, for good reason, had been associated for centuries with evil, with goblins, with the devil, with Satan, but also, of course, wolves and thieves. And in fact, the edict that leads to the beginning of public lighting in Paris is issued in the very same year that the police of Paris is instituted. And in fact, it's the police that take control of public lighting. And in this opening edict, the beginning paragraph mentions murders and robbing and thievery that goes on at night in Paris. That Paris is an unsafe place and it needs to be publicly lit. Now, the irony is that it's not at all clear that public lighting in the 18th century actually reduces crime. And in fact, it creates a new crime, and that is smashing lanterns, which goes on all over Europe and, in fact, in the New World in the 18th
why
century.
Why would people smash lanterns?
Well, so we think of light as just something good, but you have to sort of put yourself back in the frame of mind of people who had never had public lighting at night. Light is, first of all, expensive, and so ordinary people don't have it. And the city at night is kind of a no-go zone for most people, except for perhaps prostitutes or thieves and robbers. And from these people's perspective, public lighting is a kind of colonization. It's a taking over of the space that belongs to them at night, a taking over by the state. And so there are people who, you know, just break lanterns to sort of resist this new move. This, you know, it's very much like putting security cameras in places, if you will.
It's kind of government control.
Exactly. And it's viewed very much like that in the 18th century, in fact. The very first public hangings in the French Revolution of 1789 were done on the Place de Grève from a lantern post. And you get the beginnings of a new word in French, lanterner, to lantern, literally to string somebody up by the lamppost or the lantern.
Of course, this is long before electricity, long before gas as a source of fuel. So how were these public lights lit? What was the fuel?
Right. So the fuel initially is just candles, tallow candles made from animal fat. Basically, the technology of light doesn't change from the beginning of human beings' ability to control fire till the 18th century. So initially, tallow candles, but then people start using oil. Now, oil lamps are also old. The Babylonians had oil lamps. The Romans had oil lamps. But they're put to new effect in Amsterdam in the 18th century and then later in Paris using, at first, vegetable oil or oil made from animal fat, But then increasingly in the second half of the 18th century, whale oil, which is provided by Americans, and Nantucket and Bedford and the whaling industry kind of comes online promoting what is really a revolution in lighting practices in this period.
So was that actually the thing that fueled the whale industry, the need for oil for lighting?
Very much so. I mean, there are different uses for whale oil, but providing light is the most important.
So this must have been just a dramatic change in how people lived. I mean, suddenly you had, at least in certain cities or certain parts of cities, they were lit up at night.
Exactly.
And it used to just be darkness, and that must have totally changed the way people lived.
Right. And we have to sort of slow down a little bit in the sense that what the 18th century considered public illumination, we would think of as a kind of speck in the dark, right? These tallow candles particularly don't burn evenly. They blow out in the wind. They gutter. So 18th century illuminated cities are still dark by our standards. And yet from the perspective of people, as you say, who've never had public lighting, it dramatically changes the way people live.
So what did that mean in practice? I mean, I guess people, they could stay up later, obviously.
Sure.
And I assume there were public gathering places. I don't know, coffee houses, bars that were suddenly, they were open at night, no?
Very much so. The famous German philosopher Jürgen Habermas wrote a book in which he argued that really coffee house society is the first place for a locus of public opinion. You get people coming together in coffee houses who wouldn't ordinarily socialize and exchanging views and arguing on the basis of reason. And this becomes a model for a new kind of democratic sociability. Well, what's not often appreciated is that those coffee houses are open at night and most people are going to them in the evenings. And that wouldn't have happened in a culture that didn't have well-lit streets that provided a modicum of safety. Shopping, right? You can look at the 18th century and shops start to open later and later into the night. By the end of the 18th century, you can buy high-fashion clothes in Paris as late as 10 or 11 in the evening. Going to the theater, theater hours become later and later in the 18th century. The dinner hour becomes later and later. The other really important and dramatic change is sleeping patterns. A great historian by the name of Roger Ekirk wrote a really important article a number of years ago in which he showed that early modern Europeans and Americans as well slept in two cycles. There was a first and a second sleep. And so basically people would come in from the fields, they'd have a quick meal, and when the sun went down, they'd go right to sleep. And then after 4 hours or so, they'd wake up. And in the middle of the night, they would, you know, chat, sit by the fire, sew, make love, eat, do what they will.
But mostly in the darkness, unless there was a fire there.
Right. A fire for most people would have been about it, right? And then they would have gone back to sleep until the sun came up. But their life rhythms were controlled by the rising and setting of the sun.
Now, you said earlier, you see a connection between this dawning of public lighting and enlightenment, which is a spiritual idea, basically.
Very much so.
I mean, light meaning truth in a way. So how much are you going to draw that,
right,
that connection?
Well, as you say, light, in fact, you can argue that light is the most important metaphor for truth in the Western tradition going all the way back to the
ancient world. And not even just in the Western
world.
Tradition. It's sort of like throughout,
right,
religious,
well, it's
traditions.
Even striking. In the Christian, of course, in Jewish traditions, we know that, you know, that the Fiat Lux is the first creative act of Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible. Jesus proclaims himself as the light and the way. But as you say, in almost every major religious or wisdom tradition, light is equated with God or spirituality. But the other thing that's going on, at least in the Western tradition, is that almost every metaphor for ideas is associated in some ways with seeing, right? So the very word idea comes from the Greek idein, which simply it means to see. And you can go on down the list. Speculate is cognate with a spectacle or a speculum, which is an old word for mirror. So seeing, having something illuminated, and knowing go very, very closely together. But the other thing that is going on, as you say, is that people are actually creating light, right? Light doesn't just fall out of the heavens. People are producing light, lighting their cities. And I think that this is a very powerful metaphor for human beings' ability to illuminate their own way, right?
So in other words, it's no longer sort of waiting for divine revelation to strike. I mean,
right,
you are making that revelation.
You're
now
making that revelation, and in the process, you're creating urban spaces that are models of progress, of modernity. The other thing that is, I think, so fascinating is that so many people we associate with the Age of Enlightenment were themselves interested in lighting technologies. So in the United States, the best example is Benjamin Franklin, who's the son of a tallow chandler. His father made candles for a living. But Franklin himself was interested in candle technology. He's interested in public lighting, and in fact, he takes a major role in promoting public illumination in Philadelphia, which is one of the first cities, along with Boston and New York, to have public lighting in the United States. The great chemist Antoine Lavoisier in France, he's thought of as the father of modern chemistry, is concerned his whole career in developing lantern technology, looking at angles of refraction. He's the one who really figures out that air or oxygen is involved in fire and burning, and so he leverages that technology to start working on new types of lanterns. And you can go on down the list. A great number of Enlightenment thinkers are themselves interested in light and thinking very self-consciously about the relationship between practice and the metaphor.
So, Darren, you've been sort of looking into this history of light. Do you think about light differently? I mean, do you look at light, and does it mean something new to you now?
Well, you know, one of the things I love to point out is that, and this is, I think, a direct product of my research, is that we take light for granted now, right? First of all, it's so cheap. And yet that wasn't the case for most of human history. Light was expensive. In fact, until the 18th century, it's really a luxury of elites. I mean, burning candles costs a lot of money. And say 1800, you could buy about 10 minutes of light with an average worker's wages for an hour. Well, now you could buy about a year of light with an average worker's wages for an hour. So I don't take it for granted in the same way as I used to.
Well, it seems to me there's an irony that you've just suggested, which is now we take lighting so for granted. And we're just, I mean, especially if we live in cities, we're surrounded by light. I mean, now darkness is valued. And, you know, and there's
much.
A whole movement to try to create certain areas, like on bike paths near my house, that is not lit or just very dimly lit because, you know, people complain about too much light.
Absolutely. Light pollution. And in fact, people already are starting to talk about light pollution in the 18th century. There's a worry that artificial light is bad for the eyes, that it contributes to people staying up longer and then getting into trouble and mischief. But that, yes, that it sort of changes the serenity of the natural world, that there's something unnatural about the way that we sleep in a world which is lit all night, something unnatural about the way that we approach nature itself. And yeah, now we try to get away from it when we can.
Well, this is totally fascinating.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Dartmouth College historian Darren McMahon talking with Steve Paulson. Darren's written histories of happiness and genius, and he's now working on a book about the history of light. Up next, a physicist explains how much more there is to light than meets the eye. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International.